I don't know if he has a restraint. I don't know if he knows how to tell himself no.
Day two of sentencing hearings for the man who admitted to setting fire to 7 buildings and 2 rivers in 2021. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 27th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, an outage in Newtok School is just the latest in a pattern of power issues.
You know, every year during this time, we have power and water issues in Western Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Build rockets, study wildlife, code robots, and work with kids in after-school programs across Alaska. Now hiring full and part-time STEM coaches through AmeriCorps to engage elementary-age students in science, technology, engineering, and math. Do meaningful work and gain professional experience in education. Apply online at akafterschool.org/AmeriCorps or call 907-248-7379. This message is sponsored by the Alaska After School Network.
A sentencing hearing for admitted arsonist Jameson Gallion concluded Wednesday at the state courthouse in Fairbanks. The proceeding included testimony from an arson victim, sentencing recommendations from attorneys, and an apology from the 19-year-old Gallion. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Jameson Gallion pleaded guilty last year to setting fire to 7 buildings in the summer of 2021 in the Pleasant Valley, Two Rivers area east of Fairbanks. Some of the structures were occupied, but no one died in the fires. 2 of the arsons targeted the Pleasant Valley Community Association, to which Gallion also sent taunting and threatening letters. In a phoned-in victim statement, Association President Wayne Shea questioned Gallion's self-control.
I don't know if he has a restraint. I don't know if he knows how to tell himself no. I don't know if he knows right from wrong.
Shea asked that Gallion be sentenced to the maximum allowable for the felony arson, burglary, criminal mischief, and terroristic threatening crimes. State Attorney Anna Ralph noted that Gallion was 17 when he committed the offenses and had no prior record, but recommended 35 years, with 18 suspended in light of the seriousness of his crimes.
This defendant terrorized an entire community and caused multiple named specific victims over a series of months.
Gallion's attorney, Ken Cavell, countered with a suggested sentence on the low end of the presumptive range, 14 years with 10 suspended.
Jameson is here for offenses he committed as a child. Now he stands to be subject to adult penalties.
The hearing closed with Gallion addressing the courtroom. He first turned toward the gallery and apologized to arson victims in attendance.
I hate what I've done to you. And it hurts my heart to see you in this position. The way I wish I could take it all back. I'm embarrassed of my actions and will forever be sorry for hurting and scaring everybody.
Gallion, who lived off Chena Hot Springs Road and has family in Two Rivers, did not explain what motivated the arsons, but said he understands he has problems and must find more suitable ways of dealing with them. Ginger and Donnie McKee, who escaped a fire that destroyed their multi-structure home and business property, say the state's recommended sentence is too short.
We do not accept 17 years to serve. We do not accept that.
Judge Paul Lyle set February 2nd as the sentencing date for Jameson Gallion. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska is expecting to see an average of just over 500,000 barrels of oil produced per day on its lands and waters through the next 5 years, representing a slight increase due to an expected new slate of projects on the North Slope. That's according to a Monday presentation from the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas to the Alaska House Finance Committee. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Travis Peltier is a petroleum reservoir engineer with the division. He told committee members the vast majority of oil production in Alaska will come from the North Slope, but he says the few thousand barrels per day produced in Cook Inlet have an important use in the state, too.
One really critical piece of information that I wanted to share on the Cook Inlet, however, is that oil from the Cook Inlet Basin is critical to the supply of in-state refineries. So a lot of usage comes out of the oil that we generate in the Cook Inlet itself.
The production forecast is part of a group of presentations requested at the start of each legislative session to help the legislature determine how to shape the budget for the next fiscal year. Oil production in Cook Inlet has been decreasing for a while and doesn't factor much into the state's budgeting process since it contributes so little revenue. The basin produced an average of 9,400 barrels of oil a day in the last fiscal year, according to the presentation, down from a recent peak of over 16,500 barrels in FY 2016. The division estimates those numbers to hold somewhat steady over the next 5 years, with a gradual decline over the next decade. The division also says one platform in the inlet, the Middle Ground Shoal, is still offline after a Hillcorp-owned fuel gas pipeline running to the unit sprung a leak in 2021. The platform was responsible for about 930 barrels of oil a day.
And production from that field is currently suspended. So zero production is coming out of there right now.
In its presentation to the legislature, the division takes note of projects that have the potential to add significant amounts of oil production to the state. The division didn't note any new projects in the inlet, but Hillcorp and South Peninsula-based Blue Crest are exploring some potential oil prospects in the Nanilchik area, according to a new activity map from the state. The North Slope, on the other hand, averaged more than 475,000 barrels of oil per day in the last fiscal year. Producers there are planning 17 new exploration and development projects in the next few years, including the Willow and Pikka projects, according to the division's presentation, as oil prices remain high and companies bounce back from the pandemic. The department's presentation was just about Alaska oil and didn't include any information about Cook Inlet gas. A highly anticipated forecast on the gas supply in Cook Inlet is expected to come out soon, says Sean Clifton with the Division of Oil and Gas. That forecast will come amid warnings from producer Hillcorp that it's uncertain about the future of its natural gas supply and could reconsider future contracts with gas-reliant rail belt utilities. Ben Betker is the energy organizer for Cook Inlet Keeper and the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. He says it's important that Alaskans have access to that data.
Gas prices and gas availability really affect us all in very fundamental ways. And people need to have good information about it.
He says a lot has changed since the last time there was a public update on gas availability in the inlet in 2018. And he says he's glad more information will be available to the public soon. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Western Alaska village of Newtok School lost power last night when a fire destroyed its power plant. The state's Emergency Management Division says the fire at the Ayaprune School happened at around 6:30 p.m. Thursday. Division spokesman Jeremy Zedek says locals in the school district were working together today on a possible fix.
So we're working with the community and trying to see what the solution to the problem is.
Lower Kuskokwim School District officials didn't initially return a call today. According to the division, the school isn't connected to the main local power grid in Newtok, about 95 miles northwest of Bethel. Residents have also been using the school's water supply as a local water source. Earlier this week, the nearby community of Hooper Bay lost power for 3 days. Bill Stamm, president of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, says the outage began Sunday when the generator ran out of fuel.
The day tank was run dry. Plant operators did not respond to fill the day tank, so the engines went down.
Zedek says power outages in the region are common during the winter months.
You know, every year during this time, we have power and water issues in Western Alaska. They're just kind of far-flung systems, and they don't have full-time linemen in a lot of these communities.
In addition to those factors, the region's infrastructure was recently strained by the remnants of Typhoon Murbach. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what to expect when the Kuskokwim 300 kicks off tonight.
Once you're out on the trail, it doesn't seem as bad as what you put in your head, you know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. Deadline is March 1st. If you've tried before, maybe this year will be your year. Many artists apply multiple times before getting the grant. Use the grant to explore, honor elders and mentors, and contribute to the vibrancy of Alaska communities. The foundation offers workshops to help artists, makers, and culture bearers. More at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by Rasmussen.org, promoting a better life for all Alaskans.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate student has found microplastics in the stomachs of spotted seals harvested in the Bering Strait region. The Alaska Beacon reports, microplastics are tiny bits of plastic, generally no bigger than a sesame seed. They are carried on ocean currents in freshwater bodies and moved around the atmosphere through winds. They are known to be harmful to fish and birds that mistake them for small bits of food. Microplastics pollution has infiltrated regions all around the world, from heavily developed and urbanized areas to remote sites. Of 29 stomachs that Alexandria Sletten examined, all but one held tiny bits of plastic. The stomachs she used for sampling were made available for her research through the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Ice Seal Biological Monitoring Project, through which seal hunters donate specimens that are stored and made available to researchers. Meanwhile, the Anchorage School District is prepared to move children to remote learning in the event a snow day closes schools. The move comes a month after a trio of winter storms closed schools for 6 days. Sven Gustafsson is chief academic officer with the district. He says when schools closed during the pandemic, students were learning virtually. Middle and high school students now have school-issued laptops to use for classes. However, Gustafsson says elementary schools weren't equipped to switch over to remote learning.
We hadn't set up any kind of remote learning piece because this is the first time in 20 years we've had such a snow event.
Even though middle and high schoolers could have worked from home during the snow days, all district schools follow the same schedule. So if one group couldn't learn remotely, all of them had to cancel classes. Over winter break, Gustafsson says he worked with each elementary school to make sure they had a remote learning plan that doesn't require a laptop.
That takes so much, even like a parent has to log on. It's so hard for families. So a lot of the schools have developed packets that can be sent home with kids for those remote learning days.
While a snow day hasn't happened this month, district officials approved a plan this week to extend school days by 30 minutes for more than a month to make up for lost class time. Gustafsson says he's hopeful the new plan will mean that snow days won't impact learning to this degree in the future.
It allows for less disruption in families' lives, I hope. Adding 30 minutes, we've heard from a lot of families that that's a hard thing.
In the meantime, school days in Anchorage will be 30 minutes longer starting on Monday until spring break starts on March 10th. For students at 8 elementary schools in Anchorage, hot lunches that included maybe a corn dog, a hamburger, or a square slice of pizza have been replaced with shelf-stable items you might find in a vending machine. That's according to an Anchorage Daily News report this week that found that staffing shortages mean the district can't provide hot lunches to hundreds of students. Daily News reporter Morgan Krakow joins me now to talk about her story. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So you note that there are 8 schools in the district that aren't serving hot lunch right now. Describe to me what's in the lunches these kids are getting instead.
Yeah, so due to a cafeteria worker shortage, they're missing this key position in 8 schools. It's a cafeteria manager, someone who usually preps like a hot lunch for students. So instead, they're being served things like nacho cheese, chicken jerky, you know, crackers, hummus, raisins. I visited an elementary school late last week and saw these sort of like cellophane wrapped packages of food that students were grabbing alongside shelf stable milk and juice. And yeah, it's really not the same. It misses out on things like a vegetable or a piece of fresh fruit or a fresh roll, things like that.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like the type of balanced meal you'd expect a school to serve to encourage learning. What does the district say about these lunches?
Yeah, you know, they're trying to hire people to fill these positions. It just sounds like they've had a really hard time doing that. Staff shortages have really ensnared the district in issues all year. We saw that with a major bus driver shortage earlier this year that led to thousands of students going without bus service for several weeks at a time. And now we're seeing this manifest in the cafeteria as well. So I think they've mentioned that they've been trying to hire people, but it just seems like that hasn't worked out just yet.
Explain how staffing shortages impact the lunches. If the food is there, what's stopping it from being served?
Cafeteria manager is this sort of specific position in an elementary school. A person comes in the morning around 9 a.m. and starts getting lunches prepared. They have to have these like specific kitchen certifications in order to do that work. So without that person on site, they're not able to give out hot lunches.
And is there any plan from the district to make a substitute for the hot lunches with something more nutritious than a vending machine snack?
Yeah, when I was at O'Malley Elementary, the principal mentioned that they're going to have some slightly more appetizing refrigerated meals going forward. I'm not sure if that's exactly district-wide or will impact all of the 8 schools, but she did bring that up as something that was going to change soon.
And you talked to several kids at the schools about the lunches. What are some of the responses you heard from kids that what they were serving or what they were being served?
Yeah, it definitely seems like these lunches leave a lot to be desired for students. They all really miss the hot lunch. You know, the popular hot lunch items were like pancakes and sausage or hamburgers and sweet potato fries, like objectively delicious things. One student did say he felt like the cold lunch was good and filling, but a lot of them really said, you know, last year we were having pizza and things like that.
Well, that was Anchorage Daily News reporter Morgan Krakow joining us. Morgan, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
The Alaska Wildlife Alliance submitted 9 proposals aimed at protecting wolves for the Board of Game meeting this month. They all failed. The Alliance is one of the groups petitioning to list the wolves on Prince of Wales Island as an endangered species. KRBD's Reagan Miller has more.
Many of the wolf-related proposals on the Board of Game's agenda last week were submitted by the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. That's an environmental group that's had a big hand in trying to add more protections for wolves on Prince of Wales Island. Carol Damberg is the president of the alliance. She says her organization was trying to help navigate what's been a controversial issue, wolf numbers on Prince of Wales.
Our goal was that we felt that it was an opportunity to provide the state and the folks that are on Prince of Wales some tools to be more precautionary in their management of wolves, to make sure that they stay off the endangered species list.
Still, she was hopeful the board would see the merit of a few of the proposals. One of the proposals asked to shorten the length of time that trappers have to report their kill from 7 days to 48 hours. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game backed that proposal, saying it would help keep accurate and timely data available for biologists.
That didn't work for the board, and it didn't work for the folks that were testifying and saying that was a tough burden to put on them in terms of safety, as well as the communications out there are sketchy.
Damberg also saw promise in a proposal that aimed to increase the target number of wolves on the island. There are ongoing studies into the topic, and she thought that might be a good reason for the proposal.
But that was our opportunity to say, well, in the interim, maybe you should raise it up a little bit to be precautionary in your management until you really know the answers that you hope to get in your analysis.
But several board members said they felt the state was handling the situation well, despite past criticism. That included board member Lynn Kia.
By and large, I think they've got a pretty good handle on this population. And like I said, everything we've got going right now is sustainable.
Members of the public, as well as regional advisory committee members, referenced the proposals throughout 2 days of public comment. Bob Yonke is a member of the Ketchikan Advisory Committee. His organization opposed every proposal from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. He said he felt like the proposal showed the organization's, quote, true colors.
For one, they are against trapping and hunting of wolves in Southeast. And number two, they have no knowledge of history or what or where wolves come from here.
But in her testimony to the Board of Game, Damberg said it's the opposite.
Although some folks try to tag us as anti-hunting and anti-trapping organization, we are not that at all. Many of our members, including myself, enjoy hunting, fishing, hiking, skiing, and all those fun things that happen in Alaska.
The board did support a wolf-related proposal brought forward by Ketchikan's Fish and Game Advisory Committee. The proposal asked to lengthen the hunting season for wolves. It will now start on September 1st, matching the federal season guidelines. Lengthening the season allows more chances to hunt wolves while already in the field, aside from the regular trapping season. The proposal was supported by the advisory committees in Craig and Klawak, but opposed by the East Prince of Wales group. That's a big reason why Fairbanks-based member Al Burnett was in support.
Generally, I'd want to give that extra portion to the trapping, or to the trapping season portion for the trappers to have. But again, I count, you know, 4 or 5 ACs that are supporting this, and countless or many other individuals, and only one AC opposed to this. So I'm going to I'm going to lean towards the ACs and the rack on this one.
The state's Department of Fish and Game was neutral on the proposal, explaining that only around 6% of wolves are hunted before trapping season begins, so they weren't expecting a huge jump in harvest. Danberg says in the end she was disappointed but not surprised all of the alliance proposals failed at the meeting.
That's the way that process works, I guess. It's okay. They feel like they are comfortable with what the state's doing, and anything that we proposed was not something they thought was necessary.
The Board of Game met in Ketchikan Friday through Monday and discussed more than 50 proposals. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Governor Mike Dunleavy announced the winners of the fourth annual education raffle on Wednesday from Harborview Elementary School in Juneau. Alaskans enter the raffle by donating part of their permanent fund dividend. Half of the donated money goes directly to schools in the form of grants. A quarter goes into an education endowment fund. Dunleavy said more than 8,700 people entered the raffle this year.
437,000 will go directly to school districts. 218,500 will go into the education endowment.
The four winners were Hannah Palmeter, John Erickson, Charles Green, and Suzanne Taylor. Their prizes range from $7,000 to $56,000. Meanwhile, Team Alaska heads to the Arctic Winter Games tomorrow night, made up of athletes that are as young as 11 and range in age up to 19. They'll fly to Canada, where they will join more than 2,000 competitors from other northern countries across the globe to compete in winter sports like cross-country skiing and hockey. It'll take two charter jets to get more than 200 athletes and 40 coaches from Anchorage to Alberta. KNBA's Rhonda McBride went to check out the speed skaters, who put in one last practice in Anchorage last night.
The rain made the oval ice skating track at Cuddy Park a little rough, so the team didn't hit their stride. But that didn't dampen Amy Fitzpatrick's enthusiasm. She's an Arctic Winter Games parent and staffer who has followed the games for years.
It's just super exciting just to watch it unfold. These kids are going to make memories for a lifetime. I think we might be coming back with some ulus.
Not the kind of curved knife that Alaska natives use to cut fish, but ulus awarded just like medals in the Olympics.
Gold, silver, and bronze. And so they're in an ulu shape, and if you get one, it's a pretty big deal.
The games take place every other year and move to a different country. They began in 1970, the brainchild of Governor Walter Hickel, who wanted to bring Arctic nations closer together to work more like a team.
My team is really great. They're really supportive, and it's really fun to skate with them.
Okay, roll around and collect back here.
Teamwork is a big part of JoJo Leonard's Alaska Native culture. As a skater of Yupik and Chupik heritage, she's excited about the chance to compete with other Indigenous athletes. After checking out the competition in Nunavut in northern Canada on Facebook, she's paying a lot of attention to
how I swing my arms, how low I am, how aerodynamic I am.
JoJo's dad, Martin Leonard, says competition at this level will help her grow as both an athlete and as a person. She's only 13, he says, and might be able to compete in as many as four different games.
She'll see these kids for almost a decade, right? And they'll compete every year in a different place. She'll make friends for life.
Those who were here on Tuesday, What were the three things I was emphasizing?
John Monroe from the Alaska Speed Skating Club coaches the team. He says the pandemic cut into their training, and teams from other countries like Canada, which have had stronger financial support, have the edge. But still,
what has been good to see is that their competitive spirit is super high, and they don't know how good they're going to do, but they're going to have fun.
Colin Sullivan, a student at Diamond High School, says while the games are pretty extraordinary, they're also wonderfully ordinary, given all that's going on in our world today.
It's just a bunch of teenagers going out and doing what they love to do, which might be the best thing that we need right now.
Alaska is slated to host the next round of games in Wasilla in 2024. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Three past champions will race in the 44th running of the Kuskokwim 300 Sled Dog Race starting tonight. The race runs from Bethel up the frozen Kuskokwim River to Aniak and back, bringing together 21 top mushers from the Kuskokwim and from across Alaska. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
2022 winner Pete Kaiser of Bethel is back to seek his seventh win. Only Jeff King has more titles than Kaiser with 9 victories. 2021 champion Richie Deal and 2019 winner Matthew Fahler join a competitive field that includes the defending Iditarod champion Brent Sass. Bethel musher Twilla Elhart is racing in her first 300-mile race and is the only rookie competing. Three others are in Bethel for their first K300, Josh McNeil, Jeffrey Dieter, and Jacob Whitcup, but because they have finished a 300-mile race before, they will not be in the running for the Rookie of the Year prize. Teams can expect a warm race with snow, rain, and temperatures reaching the mid-30s. In the days leading up to the race, Richie Deal has been tracking that weather.
It's always, you know, Cusco week, you're following the forecast. It's always something with the forecast, you know, and if you let it get to you, it gets kind of stressful, and I definitely let it get to me sometimes. So it's like, just get out there, because once you're out on the trail, it doesn't seem as bad as what you put in your head, you know.
Mushers take only 6 hours of discretionary rest, split up between the Kalskeg and Aniak checkpoints as they choose. On the return trail, all mushers rest their teams for 4 hours in Tulaksak before the final 50 miles into Bethel. They'll compete for one of the richest purses in all of sled dog racing. The winner earns a prize of $25,000. The race starts at 6:30 p.m. in Bethel. For KYUK News, I'm Ben Matheson in Bethel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Chris Clint and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Katie Anastas in Juneau, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Madeline Rose is our producer. I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planned gifts as a bequest to your local station builds a legacy that is long-lasting. Thanks for considering this option. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.